Well, as you know, I'm sure, December 10th is the anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's recognized properly, I think, as the human rights standard. It's part of what's called customary international law, recognized by U.S. courts. As in the case of other elements of international law, there is no enforcement mechanism apart from the hardly satisfactory mechanism that's provided by the operative principle of international affairs, namely the rule of force. The point was expressed, captured rather accurately by a 17th century popular poet. He described laws as like spider webs. He said, lesser flies are quickly taken while the great break out again, which incidentally rhymes in 17th century English. But you get the point. In this respect, human rights conventions are, and international law in general, are quite different from the so-called free trade agreements, or what the Wall Street Journal more honestly calls free investment agreements. For these, they impose harsh sanctions for non-compliance. That's a crucial part of the World Trade Organization regime. Here, too, in fact, the great break out again when they choose. But the sanctions do exist, and they're sometimes applied. In contrast, human rights conventions carry no penalties at all for violation. That distinction reflects the ranking of the rights of investors versus the rights of ordinary people in the prevailing doctrinal systems. It's one of many illustrations of that same fact, what of the rule of force in international affairs. Another illustration of that is prosecution for war crimes or crimes against humanity. In this case, only the weak and the defeated need apply. Furthermore, that's a matter of principle. It was explained rather clearly by Telford Taylor. He was the chief counsel for the prosecution at Nuremberg. About 30 years ago, he wrote a book, some of you will remember, on Nuremberg and Vietnam, in which he raised the question whether the Nuremberg principles would apply to the U.S. conduct of the war in Vietnam. And in it, he considered the question whether the bombing of North Vietnam can be counted a war crime. He recognized and reported that the bombing was devastating near the major urban centers where there were diplomats and journalists and Russian ships in the harbor and so on. There was a certain degree of protection, but elsewhere, you don't have to go very far away to see that much of the country was turned into a moonscape, particularly below the 20th parallel. And Taylor was well aware of that. But he pointed out, and quite accurately, that aerial bombardment, no matter how devastating, is not a war crime by the standards of Nuremberg. And he also gave the reasons, as quote him, he said, the Allies had played the terrible game even more successfully than the Germans, and therefore it would have been inequitable to charge the Nazis with crimes. Of course, it would have been equitable to charge everyone with crimes, but that was never considered, and he doesn't mention that possibility. Similarly, he points out that German admirals were exonerated from war crimes on the basis of testimony by U.S. Admiral Nimitz, who testified that the U.S. Navy had committed the same crimes, so therefore they weren't crimes. The operational definition of a war crime, as according to the Nuremberg principles, are that war crimes are crimes that somebody else committed against us, but that we didn't commit against them, or at least we can claim we didn't. In this respect, war crimes are very much like terrorism. Terrorism is terrorism that's carried out by them against us, whoever we happen to be. Our crimes are, in contrast, self-defense. Again, that holds whoever we happen to be. You can try it out. I think you'll find that it's a historical universal. And it's transmuted by power into history in another in a very specific way. That's another near universal. Notice that Taylor was talking about crimes in North Vietnam, bombing of North Vietnam. He never raised the question of the bombing of South Vietnam, which was far more intense and destructive and began much earlier. South Vietnam was also subjected to lots of other crimes that were never used in the North. For example, chemical warfare, plenty of people still dying from it. Destruction of dams, it's another war crime under Nuremberg principles. And lots of other crimes. But the South was completely defenseless, so therefore the attackers are totally immune, at least within their own doctrinal systems, ours. So there was no protest. In contrast, the North had some defenses. As I mentioned, there was an international presence, and also they had anti-aircraft weapons supplied by the Russians, which was condemned here as a crime of the Russians, but the South was totally defenseless, and therefore the attack is completely carried out with total impunity. There was never much of an issue, the bombing of South Vietnam, even in the peace movement. There was almost no protest prior to 1965. That was before the bombing of North Vietnam started, when it was only the South that was getting destroyed and hundreds of thousands of people killed. So that wasn't a case of protest, again, because it was defenseless. One of the most interesting aspects of the Pentagon Papers is a comparison of the planning for bombing of the North and the South. With regard to the bombing of the North, if you read through the internal documents, there's very meticulous, careful planning, just how far can you go without too much of a cost, and so on. In the case of the bombing of the South, there's nothing. You know, there's just no planning. You just announce, every once in a while you announce it or do it. But that makes sense because there's no cost. So therefore it's completely free. You can bomb at will. And the same is true of the huge literature on the war in Vietnam. It's enormous. But it almost never raises the question of the bombing of South Vietnam or any other major atrocities carried out in the South, because they're just normal. They're costless, and therefore they carry no stigma. These are facts that tell you quite a lot about the values that we're supposed to uphold. And all are matters that bear quite directly on the question of human rights and international law in the real world. Another illustration of that, current illustration, is given again pretty graphically by the two major crimes that brought the 20th century to kind of a fitting end. One is the Serbian crimes in Kosovo. The other are the simultaneous Indonesian crimes in East Timor. By any reasonable standard, the second are far worse, but only the first is punished, or for that matter even investigated. So immediately after the bombing of Serbia ended, Kosovo was teeming with investigators, forensic investigators attempting to find any shred of evidence they could about crimes that could be attributed to the Serbs. But forensic investigators were withheld from East Timor, despite the pleas of the United Nations, Timorese, and others. Why the difference? Well, it's pretty simple. In East Timor, the crimes can be traced right back to Washington and London, very easily, in fact, and they are, of course, immune by virtue of the rule of force, so therefore inquiry would be totally inappropriate. And the lack of inquiry, again, passes without notice. Similarly, there's a huge literature and vast indignation about Kosovo, but virtually nothing about East Timor, and that little is never reviewed or mentioned. And again, that reflects the same distinction. If 80,000 Kosovars were right now rotting in Serbian concentration camps, many dying every day, we'd know about it. In fact, we'd probably go to war. That's in fact happening right now with regard to the Timorese, but there's total silence, and for the same reasons. In fact, even the case of Kosovo reflects those crucial distinctions. So if you have a look, say, at the indictment of Milosevic for crimes in Kosovo, the indictment is interesting. The crimes are virtually without exception. The crimes that he's charged with are after the bombing, and it's surely in reaction to it.